run seminars and lectures to help inform the Parliament about issues that are before it. And today, this year, we launched a new series called the Parliamentary Library Lectures. But we'll be well used to our Vital Issues seminars, where we have a panel of speakers and we look at an issue from a number of different perspectives. But we started the Parliamentary Library Lecture Series on the basis that for some issues we needed to have a bit more depth than a short presentation. And so this is our second Parliamentary Library Lecture this year, and we will be having a third Parliamentary Library Lecture on the 11th of October, again as part of a series, but particularly focusing on the issue that we're going to start to address today. I'd like to welcome you to the Parliamentary Library Lecture. I'm Roxanne Missingham, I'm the Parliamentary Librarian, and we are very keen to continue to engage in topics of interest with our role of informing, providing analysis and advice to our clients on all of the topical issues before the Parliament. Our speaker today is Professor Lone Skeen. She came to the University of Melbourne in 1992, and in fact this afternoon she was saying, oh, I just started at the University of Melbourne the other day, but in fact it's been about 13 years. She's been in a number of roles at the University. She's currently President of the Academic Board, Pro Vice Chancellor of the University, a Professor of Law in the Law Faculty, and an Adjunct Professor of Law in the Faculty of Medicine, Dentistry and Health Sciences. She's also Deputy Director of the Centre of Law and Ethics at the University of Tasmania and University of Melbourne, the Director of the Medical Ethics Program of the Centre of Applied Philosophy and Public Ethics, which is Charles Sturt University and the University of Melbourne. She's got an extensive background in law, including 10 years at the Victorian Law Reform Commission. And she is speaking to us today in her role as spokesperson for the Lockhart Review. This is an area that she's done considerable work on, both as a panel member, but in her career looking at medical ethics, and particularly from the legal perspective, including many publications and many speeches. And I'm delighted to welcome Professor Skeen to speak to us today.
Thank you, Roxanne, and thanks for inviting me. And thank you to those who are giving up your lunchtime to come and listen to this. I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to talk to you about the Lockhart Committee. I've recently written on behalf of the committee to all members and senators offering to do briefings on these issues. And this is very unusual, because usually when people who have submitted a report like ours put in their report, you know, they stay silent and let the report speak for itself. And certainly we think that the report could speak for itself. However, there's been such a lot of debate since the report was delivered on the 19th of December. And also, there's been various scientific advances, and people might have been wondering, what is the impact of these advances on the recommendations of the committee and the need for change? So I thought that to help you understand our thinking, perhaps the best thing for me to do might be to speak a bit about the committee itself, and then speak about our recommendations and the reasons for them, and then, goodness, I know that Parliament's like this, and then I'll speak about some frequently asked questions and the responses to them, and hopefully we'll have some time at the end for questions and answers. The slides that I'm presenting, apart from the ones that show pictures, are available as you go out. And if we run out of copies, Richard Ryan has an extra copy of them. So I thought that it might be useful for people who are continuing to think about these issues and the advice that you need to be giving to constituents and other people for the reasons that you've reached the decision that you have will be assisted by looking at these slides. So here is the committee. I'm afraid it's rather a dark photograph, so you can't see it very clearly. But you can see all of the members of the committee there. And just to remind you who the committee were. So the committee was chaired by the late Justice Lockhart, who died very quickly and suddenly after the report was delivered. throughout the whole of the report and the meetings we had no idea that he was sick, and neither did he himself. So this was a terrific shock to us. After his death, it was decided that as deputy chair, I should speak for the committee. And initially it was just me that was speaking, but then after that, we decided that we should all be speaking because the issues are so complex, and sometimes a particular scientific perspective is needed. So Professor Peter Schofield's a neuroscientist, Ian Kerridge is a clinical ethicist and specialist haematologist, Barry Marshall, who's a Nobel laureate, is a research a gastroenterologist, and Pamela McComb is a consultant neurologist. So you can see from the committee, there were two lawyers, and then the rest of them were scientists. The terms of reference were wider than the terms of reference that were given to the consultants who recently prepared the Matthews Pegg report. And I'm not going to say a lot about that, but the main point I want to make here is that our terms of reference required us to consider developments in ART, so that's assisted reproductive technology, which includes IVF and other types of assisted reproductive technology, medical and scientific research, but also potential therapeutic applications. So we did give a lot of weight to what scientists told us about what might be achieved in the future from this type of technology. And we also had to consider community standards. And you'll see in the report, this is the report, which is available online, and it has an executive summary at the front and also the list of recommendations at the front. So you can find that quite easily if you want to check anything that I'm saying to you today. But there is a whole chapter on community standards because this was one of the main things that we had to consider. Now, how did we go about our research? I was just saying to Roxanne that one of the interesting things about this committee is that we didn't know each other when we started. I knew Ian Kerridge, but I didn't know anybody else. And they didn't know one another either. And when we started, we came in with a completely open mind. And we didn't know until very well into the deliberations the direction that each of us was taking in the way that we were ultimately going to recommend things. So we set up a website, and we put onto the website all of the submissions that we received, which were over 1,000. So they, unless people said that they wanted to be anonymous, they were identified, so you could see where the people were coming from by state and name and affiliation. And also you could read the submissions. All the submissions were sent to us during our deliberations on CD. You need to know this. And then in addition to that, we had face-to-face meetings with stakeholders. So they were scientists and researchers and people from the licensing committee and people from the police and the monitoring authorities. We had public meetings, which were widely advertised in all capital states and territories. Site visits, we went to places like the Australian Stem Cell Centre and Monash IVF to talk to patients and to talk to scientists. There was extensive media coverage, and we had people who were paid to do an extensive literature review. And here is our report. We met over 6 months. We had a very tight timeline for the purposes of developing the report and its recommendations. But the recommendations were unanimous. And as I said, we didn't know until quite well into the process how we were going to vote. I thought for a while that I would be writing a minority report. The others concealed so well, and I think I did too with them, what we were thinking. But we were all persuaded by this process. Now, the first recommendation is that we believe that the current national legislation should remain in place. And this was our fundamental first recommendation. And this means that there should be criminal offences to use the technology to breed identical people. Now, breeding identical people is reproductive cloning. And we have distinguished reproductive cloning from therapeutic cloning. Would you gentlemen like to come and sit down, please? I don't like to see people just come and sit down if you've got to get up and go out again. It's also an offence to sell human sperm, eggs and embryos, and we recommended that those offences should stay there because we tried to identify what are the main things that people are concerned about. People are concerned about reproductive cloning and selling of tissues. So just to emphasise this, people say reproductive cloning should be banned. So people that say stop human cloning, what they mean is they don't want duplicate people to be bred. And from our report, it's clear that there will not be duplicate people. And I include this cartoon because I like it so much to show what duplicate people sort of conscious are. And there will not be human-animal hybrids. So I'll tell you later about our proposal to use rabbit eggs to grow human stem cells. But these are not human-animal chimeras. So this will not be allowed. What we're talking about is just a few cells. And one of the other big concerns is about pressure being put on women to produce and donate eggs. And this is something that the committee was very well aware of, and I'll come back to this point. But it's important to remember that it is a crime to buy and sell any type of bodily tissue, which will include eggs, already includes eggs. So this will not be allowed. Women will not be paid in order to donate their eggs. Now, that's the first fundamental recommendation. Keep these things that people are really worried about as criminal offences. Now, we've got two pieces of legislation. We've got the Prohibition of Human Cloning Act, and we want a lot of that to still be there because that's where these offences are. And then we've got the other act. You remember when these acts were passed, they were split in the process of being passed. And the other act is the Research Involving Human Embryos Act. And we think that both of these acts should be amended. So we think that the current research on human embryos that is allowed should be allowed to continue. So under current law, it is permissible to use the embryos that are created in fertility programs and frozen for women in fertility programs, but when they don't need those embryos to have a baby, they can donate those embryos for research. So they can either donate the embryos for research, they can donate them to another couple in an IVF program, but if they don't make one of those choices, the embryos are required by law to be destroyed. So those embryos are available, and I'll come back later to why that source of embryos is not enough. But at the moment, scientists can and do research on those embryos. In order to do that research, they have to go to the Embryo Research Licensing Committee and get a license. And so far, there have been 9 licenses granted. And contrary to what many of people think, the majority of those licenses haven't been to get embryonic stem cells. Most of that research on those spare embryos is being done to improve fertility treatments. The advantage of the licensing system is that it's clear, it's transparent, and there's clear reporting that's available to everybody. So they've got to report to the license. Scientists doing this research have to report to the licensing committee, and they have to report to the parliament. So our proposal, if this research that is allowed to be done were to be extended, it would be within that same regulatory process. There would be a report to the licensing committee and to parliament, and obviously you'd have to get a license, and to get the license you have to justify the reasons why you need the embryos for research. So we think that that research should be allowed to continue, but other types of embryo research are also needed. So the first type that we need is research that goes a bit further to watch the fertilisation of an egg. And this part has not been the subject of much discussion in the press. So at the moment, scientists can do research on an egg in the process of fertilisation, but they have to stop before the egg is fully fertilised. And we proposed that instead of stopping at the point where you have to stop at the moment, they be allowed to go to syngamy, which is the division, first cell division of the egg. This is something that you can readily observe, and it's before an embryo is formed. It's the final stage in the fertilisation of the egg. And if scientists were allowed to do that, it would improve fertility treatment procedures because they could see whether an egg is going to be able to be fertilised. So one type of research they could do would be to get immature eggs from a woman, so she wouldn't have to be, you know, the eggs wouldn't have to be ripened and removed from the ovaries when ripe, which obviously involves giving her drugs. So at any time of the cycle you could get the eggs and then you could ripen them artificially, and then when they're ripe you could use those eggs without the need to give women all of these dark drugs to produce extra eggs and to ripen them. But we can't do that at the moment because the scientists can't test to see whether one of these artificially matured eggs is capable of being fertilised in the ordinary way. And you could also, so that's called oocyte maturation. Another type of research that can't be done at the moment, which would help people in fertility programs, is research on impaired embryos. So one of the main reasons why women go into IVF programs is because they're at risk of having a child with a genetic abnormality. And if the scientists could look at these embryos that are impaired and look how they develop, how the egg is fertilising and developing in the very early stages after the egg's fertilised, they would get information about what is different from an impaired embryo from an abnormal embryo. And at the moment, those diseased embryos are discarded. And obviously, the ones that are frozen for later use, that the woman might use to make a baby if the first embryos that are implanted don't work, those are good embryos. So there are no embryos available at the moment that are impaired. And those embryos are just not available for research. And then, of course, there's the one that's attracted all the publicity, which is somatic cell nuclear transfer. And that's illustrated by this diagram. And I probably don't need to go through this because if you've got the interest to come to this lecture, you will know how they do somatic cell nuclear transfer. But what is done is that they take a woman's egg, they remove the nucleus from it, and they put in the nucleus from a body cell of that woman or someone else. And the way that we regarded this is that the cytoplasm, the material in the egg, is being used to produce cells for a specific person. And we formed the view that somatic cell nuclear transfer should be permitted in the same way as doing research on embryos that are left over from IVF programs. So you'd have to get a license, you have to report, you have to justify why you're using this technology and not some other. So that's a sort of potential good that would be considered. And the reason why we took this view was because we said one day this might, we don't know whether it's ever going to lead anywhere, but one day this might give us information and possibly cures for people with serious genetic conditions. Now, we were very careful not to overhype this because we don't know where this will lead, but it is possible. And that's all in the future. So it could be a long time. You know, we've had adult stem cell research for many years now, but this type of research is very new. It'll be years before we get any therapeutic applications of it, if ever. So we're not talking it up, we're just saying it is a possibility. But what can happen right now is that we could find out more about the way that early embryos develop and the way that the stem cells are formed. And we could form stem cell lines from people who have conditions like Alzheimer's disease, because you don't want to be looking at normal stem cell lines all the time. One of the things that scientists want to study is diseased stem cell lines. And in order to do that, they're not going to get them from IVF programs. So they've got to be created specifically from the body cells of people who have those conditions for them to study. And one of the people who you may be familiar with, and I think he's come to Canberra to talk to you, is Paul Brock. But when you actually talk to people who have genetic conditions, and Paul came to make submissions to us, and we spoke to many other people with genetic diseases, and it is impossible not to be affected by seeing people like this. Now, we saw a real distinction between what you would usually think of as an embryo, where, and this was particularly when we talked to people in IVF programs. So these are people that can't have a baby in the ordinary way, and they form an embryo with her egg and his sperm, and they have these embryos to be implanted. And they don't foolishly say these are our children, but they say that these embryos have a special significance for us. These embryos carry the genetic material from both of us. And if things go well, one of these embryos will one day be our baby. So we could see from what they told us that these embryos have a special significance. And we also thought that anybody would regard a sperm egg embryo as something special. Now, we have to weigh that up against, obviously, well, I've told you already that we supported spare embryos that are going to be thrown away from IVF programs being used in research. So obviously you can say that there is an inconsistency, you might say that. But we thought that it was okay to create for a fertility program a sperm egg embryo, but not for research. We thought that it should be prohibited to create a sperm egg embryo solely for research. On the other hand, an embryo that's performed by somatic cell nuclear transfer, we thought was different. And the reason is because if you're taking the egg and using that to culture some skin cells, say, for example, we thought it wasn't all that different from culturing cells for the purpose of a skin graft. So you think if you need a skin graft because you're burnt, you take your cells and you grow them in a culture. And putting them, your skin cell or your body cell into this device, this human egg, this cytoplasm, in order to grow the cells, we didn't think was all that different from that. So we thought that you could make a distinction between a sperm egg embryo that's what you can always think of as an embryo and these other ones that are formed for the purposes of getting the stem cells. Now, I want you to know that we spent a lot of time thinking also about the counter-arguments. And we know that many people regard any type of embryo as being morally significant because of the potential for it to become a baby. So we don't know whether a somatic cell nuclear transfer embryo could become a baby because it's prohibited to put it into a woman to find out. But if you're concentrating on potential, it's not so different. So I'm going to move to some frequently asked questions, and that will bring up some of the issues that I've described here. And the first one is, can adult stem cells be reprogrammed to behave as embryonic stem cells? And this is a piece of research that you will have seen reported within the last month or so from Japan. And in this case, the scientists took some mouse skin cells, so their body cells, and they treated them, if you like, with four proteins, and they found that in this mouse, those body cells were able to be reprogrammed to behave like embryonic cells. Now, this is a mouse. This isn't a human, obviously. But I think that there is potential to apply this process to people. And if you did this, the question is, would you have an embryo? You're not creating an embryo and then getting its stem cells from it. But this entity that you've got, would that be able to grow into a fetus? We don't know, but possibly. If you're focusing on potential, yes, it would have the potential, if it were properly cultured, to grow into an embryo, and on, if it were put into a woman, to be a baby. Now, it's important to remember that even if you thought that this was a good line of research, and it does seem attractive because you don't have to create an embryo and then kill an embryo, but this entity that is being created from the skin cells does seem to be like an embryo, assuming that it could possibly be continued in development and to become an embryo, and if it were put into a woman, it would grow into a baby with a lot of intervention. I mean, I emphasise that we don't know whether this could ever happen. So if you wanted to do this is unlawful in Australia, but you'd have to change the legislation to do this, and you could set it up so this type of research is able to be done. Now, the next question is, don't embryos have a special moral status? And this is the basis of a lot of the arguments. This isn't the only argument against this type of research. Even among the scientists, opinions are divided. But we did give a lot of thought to this, and this was one of the main issues on which people made submissions to us. And we agree. We agree that there is something different about an embryo from doing research on blood cells or on skin cells. And the law reflects this. So this is reflected in the requirement that in order to do any research involving embryos, you have to get a license, you've got to go through all this reporting and justification to use the embryos. And you have to use the minimal number of embryos, and you have to treat them with respect. And we were impressed by the fact that embryologists who were doing research on embryos spoke to us about the way that they regard embryos. They, although they're using the embryos in research, they are aware that the embryo is special. It's special. And we recommended that there should be a register of surplus embryos, and a national stem cell bank should be set up to reduce the number of embryos that are going to be needed. Now, there was another experiment that was reported recently from America, where scientists said that they had taken an 8-cell embryo and they had removed from that embryo one cell, and they had developed from that one cell a new stem cell line. And we know that pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, which is lawful in Australia, follows that process. So women who are in IVF programs because they have a risk of a serious genetic abnormality can take an embryo and they have a cell removed from it. That cell is tested for the abnormality, and then the remaining 7-cell embryo is re-implanted into the woman. So this would, and babies have been born. You know, the estimates of babies in America are 1,500, 2,000 babies have been born after that process. So when people read about this, they said, this is the answer. We'll do this and we don't need to create embryos to destroy them. But first of all, this is unlawful in Australia because you're creating an embryo for the purpose of research. But even if you were creating the embryo and getting the embryo and doing the test on the single cell for the genetic diagnosis, and even if you use that cell, which you've lawfully removed, and then grow that cell up into a number of embryonic stem cells for research, what is the moral status of that new entity? And it could grow into an embryo. So not only is that unlawful, but you've then got the same problem if you focus on the potential of the embryo as being the guide to the moral significance. Basically, you've created a twin and then killed the twin. And then what's going to happen to the remaining seven-cell embryo? Because no woman is going to say, well, I'll have that seven-cell embryo that's been created when I can have an eight-cell one and not take this risk. So I think it's actually unethical to do this type of research on an embryo and put the seven-cell one back in for the purposes of research. I think if there is any risk at all, it is justified by the potential benefit to the embryo of not having the genetic condition. If you know that it hasn't got the genetic condition, you then implant it and you have a healthy child, that's okay. But you wouldn't put any embryo at risk purely for the sake of science. So I think that there are a lot of problems with regard to that. Now, the next question is, why can't scientists use surplus ART embryos for research? And of course the answer is that they can, because this is lawful. But only healthy embryos are frozen, so they can't get any impaired embryos from this. And they want impaired embryos, the ones that are being thrown away, so that they can study the mutations. And also, these embryos are not matched to the particular donor, because these are made from the man's sperm and the woman's egg, so they're normal embryos. And one of the main questions that people are asking is, why don't they just do adult stem cell research? And this is one of the splits in the scientific community. So some scientists have said adult stem cell research is already producing results, and that's the way to go. We're more likely to get results there. Let's spend the money on adult stem cell research. And it's true that there are treatments, though adult, as in bone marrow transplants to cure leukemia, and they've been proven. But adult stem cells have less potential than embryonic stem cells. And scientists say that both types of research should continue to be done. If we look at other countries, particularly England, and privately funded research in the United States, they are funding both types of research. None of these scientists are saying just do embryonic. They're all saying do embryonic and do adult. We don't know where it's going to lead. But they're complementary, and you should do both of them. Then there's the question of where will the eggs come from? Now, we are worried about this. We are worried that women may feel pressured going into an IVF program, even though they're not paid. Now, I've absolutely emphasised that these women would not be paid, but there are all sorts of other types of coercion. And we're worried that women may be induced to produce more eggs than they might need themselves for the IVF program. And we recommended that the NHMRC should prepare guidelines to be followed to protect women as much as possible. We recommended that other sources of eggs could be considered. And one of those sources is, you know, where an ovary has been removed in a surgical procedure. We'd need to have a new form of maturing those eggs for this to be used. But cadaveric tissue might be a possible source as well. And then we also thought about using animal eggs. Now, I know that there is a yuck response here, and people say, you know, animal-human hybrids. But what you're using is the cytoplasm in the animal egg for the purposes of producing these human stem cells by somatic cell nuclear transfer. And This would be used only for research. This entity would not be allowed to be developed. And so what you're trying to do is to have a ready source of growing up human stem cells for the purposes of doing this research. And the material that's coming out of this is human. So the more it multiplies, the more human stem cells you get from this procedure. Now, one of the main issues that's been raised in the press just recently, particularly with the PM consulting report, is what has changed since 2002. And this is why I emphasised to you at the start the scope of our terms of reference. There have been significant scientific developments. It's true we've got no cures. There are no cures. We know that. But there is more understanding. And science is incremental. You don't know where it's going to lead. It's like a patchwork. You just get a bit here and a bit there and a bit there, and then suddenly it comes together and produces a whole, some new insight. Medical research has a very long lead time. So it's at least 10 to 12 years for a new drug. Embryonic stem cell research is proceeding apace overseas, particularly in the United Kingdom and privately funded US projects. So all of that research is taking place and publications are coming out, things are being discovered. But one of the main things that's happened since 2002 is that community attitudes have changed. Professor Suzanne Corey, who's the head of the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute, said that the test tube baby used to seem outlandish, but attitudes evolve. If you understand more, you fear less. And this is certainly what we found with our surveys from Biotechnology Australia of the changes in community attitudes. So a question, what do you think that stem cell research is likely to be useful? And in case you can't see this, this is the one with embryonic stem cells, and the white band is yes. So you can see that many people are saying that embryonic stem cell research is useful. And here, perceived risks, and here again is embryonic, this one is stem cells generally, and that's not embryonic. But you can see that the people who believe that there is a risk is not all that different across the spectrum of different types of stem cell research. Now, are scientists creating false hopes? And this is something that we warned the scientists against. There is always a tendency when you're trying to get money for medical research to talk up your research. And we were very aware in talking to patients and patient support groups of the impact that this might have for them. And we noted that the scientists are not making any promises about this, and they're cautious in saying where it might lead, but obviously people who need this hope fall upon it, and we were aware of that. So we thought that there should be community education programs to help understand about the science, but particularly to understand the limits and how long all this is going to take. And my final slide is, why should one person's moral views restrict the freedom of others? And we found that this is the sort of issue on which people who think things through and really care about the community can have different views. And so eventually there will be points on which the view is irreconcilable. So if you take the view that anything that is potentially an embryo that could be a fetus, you won't let any of this be done, including these things that people have been welcoming, as they might avoid the need to be creating and destroying an embryo. You're going to rule out a lot of that research. And so we respected those views. We didn't try and reconcile them. But what we did say is that there are many communities in Australia. So for myself, you know, I belong to lots of communities. I'm a lawyer. I'm an academic lawyer. I'm a mother. I'm a young woman. I have children. So when you think about all of the aspects that might, and of course I'm a churchgoer, when you think about the things that influence your views, I'll get my views from all of these communities. And I might hold different members of each of these communities might hold other views from mine. So we thought it's very difficult to try and reconcile the views and just say we're going this way. What we wanted to identify at the start is that there are going to be different views. And people don't have to be mad to hold a view different from yours. They just see the world differently. So we acknowledge that these views will coexist. And we took the view that if there is one group of people who don't want this research to be done, when there is a potential benefit for other people, there's a very high onus on them to prove to the others why it shouldn't be done. And we didn't think that they have the right just to say that because they object to it, therefore it shouldn't be done. So when people say to me, you know, what about your religious or moral views? You know, what do you think about the embryo? I say, well, I have other moral values. And my moral values lead me to believe that scientists should not be stopped from doing this very important research, which will yield knowledge and may one day yield cures. So I'm open for comments and questions. Yes.
I have concerns about the recommendation 24, not so much the embryo being used for research, but it also says clinical applications. What, and I'm worried,
yes,
from a safety point of view.
Yeah. What we had in mind here was a test for the motility of sperm, which is used in other countries. So if you have a man who doesn't produce very many sperm, and you want to know whether the sperm that he is producing are capable of fertilising an egg, you don't want to waste a woman's egg on that test. So it would be possible, and this is done in other countries, to take a hamster egg, to fertilise the hamster egg with the man's sperm. If it starts to fertilise, you know that his sperm is capable of fertilisation, and then it would, that entity would immediately be destroyed.
But that's recommendation 17, and that's what I thought we meant.
Let me just have another look at 24.
Recommendation 17 is, and the UK has this hamster test, which is fine as far as I'm concerned. But recommendation 24. And the first time I read it, I didn't notice, and then I realised that it said in recommendation 24, which is to create embryos to achieve stem cells, to harvest stem cells, that actually has clinical applications in it. And so I was curious about that.
Yeah. Well, it would be to, I've given one example. But, I mean, it depends what you mean by clinical. We certainly didn't intend that this should ever be put into a person. So it's to improve clinical procedures. Another example might be to study the impact of different types of media in improving the success of fertilisation. Improving the medium in which an egg is being fertilised could have a clinical application. But you would never, it's to yield knowledge. It's not to produce anything that would be used in a person.
But 24 is to, recommendation 24 is to produce stem cells, and presumably you're going to do something
but
with those stem cells.
Yes, but when I'm saying, when they're saying clinical, we don't mean that it's something that you would put into a woman, because it's absolutely prohibited that these embryos are not implanted in the body of a woman or allowed to develop more than 14 days.
No,
so if there were a clinical application, it would be something that follows from the research, not from the actual substance that's created.
My concern that the stem cells derived under recommendation 24 would be used for a therapy, not for implantation, but used for a therapy.
Well, we certainly don't intend that that should happen.
It just wasn't clear.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yes, Professor Skene, Guy Barnett, Senator from Tasmania. I'd like to share an observation and then two questions. Firstly, that last question there I do find quite offensive. Every day in this Parliament, we make decisions based on our moral views and our views, rightly or wrongly, that restrict the freedoms of others. Every day we do that in this Parliament. That's my observation. Just in regard to your comment, you said that...
I'm sorry if I've offended you. I have tried to show that we're very aware of views of others and we don't put those views down.
That question, I'm just referring to the question. You said specifically that human-animal hybrid and human-animal chimera are not allowed, but recommendation 24, my understanding is, and I think you said that animal eggs could be used to host human nucleus for research purposes.
Yes, but it depends what you mean by a chimera.
Is your definition of a human-animal hybrid different to other people's definitions?
Yes.
So can I just...
To answer that question, please. Sure. Yes, we have taken the view that if you're building... And that's why I showed you the slide of the half-human, half-person... half-human, half-animal, because that, for us, is what a chimera is. What we've proposed is that this type of procedure should be used for the purposes of producing stem cells. And we have regarded that differently from creating a human-animal chimera of the type that I showed you in that slide.
I'll get back to definitions. In terms of the Lockhart report, you've recommended cloning, but in terms of the report, and I've reviewed it, had a look at it, the only peer-reviewed report that you've relied on is the Korean research, which has subsequently been found to be fraudulent and indeed unethical in many ways, and I think that's now on the public record. There hasn't been any sort of clarification of the record. You've said, they have been reported as saying, that there were other reports that you've relied upon.
Well, if you look
I can't find them in the Lockhart report or the Lockhart document that has been available to, in the public arena, so I'm wondering, can you advise us what reports you've relied upon to support your recommendation in favour of cloning other than the Korean research?
Yes, well it is true, if you look at the paragraph that describes the Korean research, obviously at the time when that research was reported to the Lockhart Committee, we didn't know that later that would be discredited. With regard to publishing a retraction, once the committee had completed its report, the committee was actually wound up. And so although we can make statements personally, and you know, to the extent that I'm speaking here on behalf of the committee, I'm speaking to this report. And so the committee is wound up, and the committee had no formal way of making amendments to the report, I suppose. So we obviously accept that that experiment that was described in the report has been discredited later. An English scientist who is a leader in this field has told me that he has done... I said, you've done the same thing. And he said, no, it's not the same. But he told me at a conference in Brisbane last month that his unit has actually done the same thing, but it's not been published. So I'm not relying on that one. But if it hasn't been done already, I think it will be done. You'll see in the same paragraph that describes the or mentions the Korean experiment that there are references to other studies. Now, I can't tell you off the cuff what they were, but I'm very happy to get chapter and verse and come back to you, because obviously if I try and answer now, I won't have it right. I'd rather give you the specific details of it.
I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Excuse me, Professor Skene, you've talked about different sources of the eggs, cadavers and IRT and animals, but is there any estimate of how many eggs would be required?
No, and the estimates vary. Certainly we know with Dolly the sheep where they were trying to create a whole sheep which is a different thing. But I think it was 149. Could somebody correct me if I haven't got that right? But it was certainly a lot of eggs and attempts were needed. Now, with these experiments, they're not allowed to create a whole individual. But is the difficulty in doing the research just achieving the initial fertilisation or taking it further? I don't know the answer to that. Some scientists have said that quite a few eggs will be needed. So far in the experiments that have been done on the... No, I'm sorry, I'll take that back because they're all on... I think the answer to your question is that we don't know. And there have been different estimates. We don't know how efficient the procedure will be in if it's allowed to be done for somatic cell nuclear transfer. So we don't know if there will be in the tens or the hundreds.
Professor
Steen,
Natasha
Scott, just one. Yeah, nice to see you, Natasha.
Can you talk me through the recommendation in relation to cytoplasmic transfer and the rationale for that recommendation?
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you're going to include that recommendation in a private member's bill, for example, I just thought it'd be interesting to hear the lockout recommendation on that, because obviously it's one that was debated certainly in the committee stage last time and can be seen as quite.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, at the moment the law states that you can only form an embryo, for use in a fertility program, and B, using the genetic material of two people. So this means that you take a man's sperm and a woman's ovum, and they then become the parents. And obviously this material can be donated. If the man's infertile, you can have donated sperm and a donated egg, or you could have a donated embryo. But what you're getting there is, in the embryo, is the sperm, is the genetic material only from two people. Now, what we recommended was that it should be possible to use cytoplasm, which is the material in the egg that's not the nucleus, the sort of round... try not to say jelly part, but you know, the cytoplasm of the egg. If you could get that from a third person, from another woman, and put that into the egg that you're forming for use in a fertility program, and obviously we'd have to do this in a research basis first to see if it's safe and works, but this would be the only way that we can see at the moment to avoid the woman passing on mitochondrial diseases in her egg, other than getting a donated egg. So if you have a woman with a mitochondrial disease that's carried in the female line, who wants to have a baby that's genetically related to her, this would be the only way that you could do it. And you'll see a report in the press of genetic material for more than two people, and a suggestion that it might even be more than that. Well, in fact, already embryos have genetic material, may have genetic material for more than two people, because if you have the sperm from the man and the egg from a woman, from both from a donor, and they form the embryo, and the embryo is then put into the woman who gestates that fertilised egg, the egg will also take in material from her own body. So it is that is already happening.
Yes. I do apologise for being late. Kay Hull from Riverina, but we've had divisions in the chamber, so I do apologise, and you may have answered this question.
No, feel free to ask again.
Okay. I'm just, in 2002 when we were debating the issue, and we were debating the issue on surplus IVF embryos, there was no view at that time that there was a requirement that we would want therapeutic cloning. What I would like to understand is have we used all of the available eggs? All the available embryos that were relevant to 2002.
Well, certainly not. there was a cut-off point in the earlier legislation. You had to have eggs that were formed before that time, yes. But that has now gone, so that we could use any of the eggs that are frozen after IVF programs. And there are lots of them. So people say, well, you've got all those eggs frozen. You've got couples who are, in fact, keen to donate eggs for research. So why don't you use those eggs? And I have got a slide on that. And I did say that, first of all, those eggs will be good eggs because you don't freeze impaired eggs. You only freeze the ones that you might be able to use later to have a baby. So there's no source there of impaired embryos. And scientists want to do research on impaired embryos to find out what's wrong with them. So when I was in Brisbane, an obstetrician from the UK got up and she said, every day women come into my surgery and they say to me, what's wrong with my baby? Is it going to happen again? Why did it happen? Is there anything I can do about it? So to get that research, you need to be able to do research on embryos that you wouldn't implant, you wouldn't freeze. These embryos are always discarded. So if you have people coming into an IVF program to avoid the transmission of a serious genetic condition, and they have pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, and they take the one cell off the 8-cell embryo, and they find that the embryo is impaired, then it is discarded. And the scientists want to do research on those embryos. So that's one of the recommendations in the research, that they, in the report, that they should be allowed to do that, to help understand what goes wrong in the early stages. We know that there are over 1,500 genetic disorders, and we need to find out what's happening in that early stage of the fertilisation procedure. The other reason why it's not enough just to use those embryos, that we say those embryos should be available for research, because otherwise they must be discarded unless the parents give them to somebody else in a fertility program, that those embryos come from that couple, the man and the woman, you know, sperm and egg, and they're not matched to a person. So one of the other things that scientists would like to be able to do is to create, you know, a disease model, they call it. So if they get skin cells from somebody who has a disease like Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's disease, and they can cultivate those stem cells by using somatic cell nuclear transfer, they then have stem cells that have got this condition. And they can then study those. Now, obviously, you're never going to put those cells into anybody, but you want to look at those cells and see, you know, what is it about the way those cells operate that makes the body develop the disease? So those sorts of experiments need to be done on embryos that are created by somatic cell nuclear transfer.
Thank you very much, Professor. I'm glad you're there. It might be my turn soon, but anyway. I want to know, in the inquiries or people coming with presentations, and I don't know that you've mentioned this, did anybody put the point of view that from synth stem line cells, that's from somatic nuclear transfer cells, that you may be able to derive a stem cell line, not a diseased one, but a stem cell line to assist someone with a blood product, for example, to replace blood cells when they've got leukemia, or to replace heart cells that are less likely to be rejected than from the embryonic one because the tissue is not matched to them. Yeah. We talked about disease, but I was wondering if people have argued there may be
other therapeutic applications. Yeah. Yes, that's right. I mean, obviously it's conjecture. We don't know where this type of technology might lead. The thing that is least likely to happen, it's in the short term, is that we're going to get stem cell lines that are matched to people that we put into the people to cure their disease. Now, that is what we are hoping will eventually happen, but that's years off. So in the meantime, the first thing that we might get is tissue that we can study, including stem cell lines and these sort of embryos. And I'm not shirking calling them embryos, because I think that, you know, if we call them something else, we're not being honest. So we can get these embryos initially to study straight away and to find out what's wrong with impaired ones. And we can produce embryonic stem cell lines, which we can do from the ones that we've already got left over from IVF. But there may be lots of other potential therapeutic applications that we're just starting to think about, of the kind that you described. Yeah. And certainly we did have submissions about other potential uses.
Kerry Neff from New South Wales, and I wanted to ask you about aspects that relate to the commercialisation of stem cell research, and I know you received a number of submissions.
Sorry, what was the question about?
About commercialisation and public and private issues, because you know I want to ensure that any treatments and cures are available for people across the board. They're not simply a circumstance where people are donating eggs that are then used for private profits where they're not able to access the treatment because of the cost. Now, obviously that's across the board in relation to research and very difficult to regulate, but I'm wondering what sorts of suggestions you have in relation to either licensing procedures that could be brought into play to ensure that there was a public benefit that would come out of any results or research. And I suppose I wanted to ask that question slightly separately to the issue of the National Stem Cell Bank, for which there's a clear recommendation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you for that question. You might note that I haven't mentioned commercialisation other than to say it was one of our terms of reference throughout all of the talk, because it wasn't the potential financial rewards that influenced our thinking. And even the fact that we now know that some of our leading scientists like Martin Perer and Paul Simmons have left to go to the United States because they can do the research there and they can't do it here. But again, that didn't influence our thinking. However, it is true that the state governments of Victoria and Queensland in particular are very aware of the potential of the biotechnology industry in those states. And they see that in time there may be very substantial financial rewards. I must say that when I talk to scientists, I don't share the cynicism that people have commonly of individual scientists. I don't see them making a lot of money. I see them looking for things that are going to help the public good. But in time, there will be commercialisation. And it is a fact that we have a patent system that protects intellectual property over a short period of time while the inventor has a monopoly in order to gain a financial advantage from a new invention. And the inventor can't sit on the patent, so it's important to know that if an invention is patented, the inventor has to make it available for widespread use, but of course it is at a cost. So what you're drawing attention to is that there may be situations where people have participated in the research and there is a benefit which they don't necessarily get free. And so far this has applied in a number of areas of research. That's something that many people are concerned about. It would be possible to, you know, vary that by an agreement with the person who's making the donation initially, but that's not a common practice. So I think that this is an issue. We hope that the government, when cures are available, will make them available on the national pharmaceutical benefits scheme. But you know, that is a political decision too.
Professor, you say you don't share the cynicism of scientists, etc., that might be out there, but you have the experience as a Korean experiment that has been discredited. Surely there has to be a recognition that when this happens, it does reduce the confidence of the people of the intention or the motive behind why you would falsify outcomes of research.
And I think it was a tragedy for the field. I think it was a terrible thing for the man concerned. I mean, if you think that he hasn't been punished enough, he's lost his reputation, he's lost his job, he's set the whole country reputation back. So you have mavericks everywhere. Sometimes you have somebody who's dishonest. But I spend a lot of time at scientific conferences. I look at lots of posters of things that are people where people are presenting their research. And I, you know, I think that that's a rare instance.
We might like Mike, that the last question. Before we thank Professor Scanlon for the presentation, I wanted just to mention that the overheads and the audio of the presentation today will be up on the Parliamentary Library website in the next day or two. There are some copies of the overheads which you're welcome to collect on the way out. If you would like the overheads, a copy of the printed overheads today when we run out, Richard will take your name and make sure you get a copy this afternoon. Because there's a lot of information that we've had to discuss here today that I think a lot of people will want to digest, because it is a very complex set of issues surrounding human cloning.
And well, you can ask me questions later and give me time to look things up too. This is hard stuff. I mean, I'm a lawyer.
And the Lockhart Review has been a very important review, and I think we've benefited enormously from having Professor Scanlon here today to speak to us. So on behalf, I'll thank her and I'll ask you all to thank her. The Parliamentary Library lecture will be on the 11th of October. Thank you very much. You can have a nice lunch.